I'ma say what I feel, and I promise to keep it real.
Welcome to the Red Room. Boom, 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 boom. Yeah. So you wanna be a rider? Well, you gotta be a rider till your fears are diminished and the doubts are behind ya. It's hard to grind and the business got me stressed in the Red Room. We let that shit up off our chest. Never have to guess when you're listening to Hilliard. He gon' bring more game than a shark playing billiards. It's all about the craft of screenwriting. It's exciting when you turn an outline into something enlightening. Your pen and words are like bullets in a gun. Write what you feel, say what you want.
Welcome to the Red Room.
What's up, y'all? It's your boy, Hilliard Guest, and you guys are listening to the Screenwriters Rant Room. We keep it real, we keep it opinionated, we keep it what, Chris?
2023.
I said two.
You didn't know what year it is. Dear listeners, this is a time machine episode. We are dialing back in time to before the strike.
I hear a clock.
Time was happier and there was less strife in this industry. At least there was less public strife in this industry.
Exactly, exactly. On this show, we discuss entertainment, TV, film, music, culture. But our focus is always screenwriting, stories, craft, and shit like that. You hear his voice. Chris Derrick is over here in the building, back again. He is the Incredible. This is probably going to be a month before this is out, but it'll be out in a minute. So, in the meantime, what happens over the next month, Chris?
Are
we going into week 15? Is that what it
is? Yeah, we're going to week 15. I'm about to drop my this week's episode of the Substack Thin Ice later tonight, or maybe tomorrow, depending.
Remind everybody what that is.
So Thin Ice is my Substack newsletter. There'll be a link in the bio, whatever, the show notes to follow it. I just talk about movies, films, comic, art, culture, and occasionally I'll talk about worldwide economics because I can. And
Rich is really excited.
So a lot of times when I jump into the discussions about the strike, I kind of take the point of view of the lens of from the person who thinks about it from the economics and the finance, because that was my background in school. So I take that lens all the time. Like, oh, they're making these choices because of this, or not because they don't care, but it's like, what are they thinking about? I mean, a couple of things I was going to say. I was thinking about this talking to a friend of mine the other day, and he was like, so do you think they're going to settle soon? I was like, it's not even if they settle soon. What I don't think people are thinking about is we have to get a deal that protects us or gives us protections up through the 2032 negotiations.
It's true. They don't think. They just think what do we need now?
Right now. Because
it's always about the future.
Here's the thing that I was telling my friend, and he was like, well, why do you say that? I was like, okay, so it was 4 or 5 years ago now, maybe a little more, when the movie called Rogue One came out, that Star Wars film. And in that Star Wars film, they used the computer technology to resurrect Peter Cushing to put Grand Moff Tarkin. And then they used like a photo double and then de-aged Carrie Fisher.
Oh. So, I'm sorry to interrupt. Did they do a version of that in Fast and the Furious for Paul? Or did they not?
Saving that because Paul's not dead in the Fast and the Furious universe. His character's not dead. So once that technology gets to a point where they like it, just have his brother play him and do a stand-in.
Wow.
I know they're going to do that.
See what we're up against, Rich?
It's amazing.
I say that because this is what you got to think in the future is Rogue One took probably 26 to 28 months to conceive, produce, put out, everything like that.
Right.
So they had the technology to do the facial reconstruction back in 2013, 2014.
Wow.
So it was just 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But what they don't have is it's to dole it out fast and everything like that. I mean, perhaps it's just one time thing. There'll be huge money in that film. Mm-hmm. But now it's cheaper. So it's that's where it's what's the long game that they're playing?
Right.
And I think that people are like, I want to get back to work. I want to get back to my show. What about in 2029? You know, 2032?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the game they're playing. I say that because here's something else. I was reading this book a couple weeks ago called Chip War, which I put the link in the show notes. It's all about the history of the semiconductor and its industry and how it grows up and why there's rivalries like around the globe. Right. And it's like right now they're at a point where the semiconductor is, it's like 12 nanometers, like, you know, like this, like the circuit board on it, right? You know, to do that so small, you know, which is what like a nanometer is like a, it's like a millionth of a meter, something like that. To, so it's just a few atoms wide. To
do something you can't pinch.
You can't even see. So the thing is, to do that, they started developing this technology called EVU, or extreme ultraviolet light, right? Okay. They started developing it 20 years ago because they didn't know how to figure it out. And they spent 20 years trying technology, trying all this kind of crazy stuff, and then just now rolling it out. And each machine is $300 million to make, right? Just one machine with like 5,000 parts. And there's only one company in the world that makes it. But I'm saying to myself, that's how technology companies think. They think this long game.
Right.
And for us to not be in the position where we're like, I just want to deal with it, you know, so there's toys for my kids this Christmas is a mistake.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel that if no one is really talking that, then people are.
Is it because you can jump in whenever you want to, Rich? I wonder is it because we are all so used to living check to check, so to speak? Like we are so used to being the worker bees.
Well, there is that, but at the same time, you know, when you're writing a movie, when you're developing a show, you know, there's all these people who are on the strike rules thing right now, which are potentially breaking strike rules. They're doing it because they're like, I spent 8 years to get this show on. Yeah, you spent 8 years.
Right.
What have they been doing for 8 years? Figuring out how to replace you.
Yeah, easily.
So that's where, you know, they're like, okay, keep making your show, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but that's the point. I mean, that's where I think we have to really be thoughtful. And I was reading that thing. Obviously, it's going to be late, so it might change by the time this comes out. But, you know, on Friday, they had the meeting with the Writers Guild. They sat down.
Hopefully, by the time this comes out, we've solved something.
I have something. But they were talking about... we're not going to talk about AI yet. We're not, some of these are not going to talk about, you know, and it's like, really? Really?
That's such executive jargon.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I was on the way in speaking with your security
guy. Rich Redlow, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Pre-WGA.
Right. You're getting there. You're getting there.
I was speaking with your security guard, Roland, who, by the way, has a second job driving trucks,
right?
Sometimes long hauls. And on his long hauls, he listens.
I never knew that, Chris.
I don't know.
He's never told me this, ever.
Yeah, we had a nice long talk. And he and I were agreeing about the strike, about the AI portion of the issues, that it's the first strike that's going to deal with it for all of society.
Mm-hmm.
And he, as a truck driver, knows that there will be self-driving vehicles, including self-driving trucks.
Yeah.
And eventually, in every industry, there will be, you know, all the workers will be replaced. And then, so... just talking about trucking, what do trucks do? They deliver groceries. They deliver things to department stores.
Right.
But eventually, no one's going to have a salary anymore, and no one's going to be able to afford those groceries or to buy things in department stores. No one's going to have money except for the top tech executives.
Right.
And so this strike is so important, not just because of the entertainment industry, but because of any industry.
Right.
And it seems the producers are so short-sighted, they're destroying their own industry.
I don't think that they're short-sighted. I think that their goals are different. Their goals and their values are don't care. I want to get my $300 million stock options, which will vest in like 3 years, and then who cares what the collapse is? I'll have my private army sitting around, everything like that.
My children's children will be fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, there's two movies that come to mind when I think about what they're thinking about. It's Children of Men.
Mm.
And a movie called Elysium,
Matt Damon
movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at those movies, like Children of Men takes place in London, but it is so troubled. Like, you got people in cages on the streets. There's you know, there's no food, all this kind of craziness going on. But there's this one scene, which I think is one of the best scenes in the movie that people think forget about because it's not dynamic mm-hmm. in terms of the rest of it.
Right.
It's when Clive Owen goes to meet Danny Houston, who's like this uber rich guy mm-hmm. who has this private security, has this house. His son is like is glued to like a handheld device at dinner table. Wow. Has got no kind of social skills because he's just so like tied up in that.
Mm.
And I was like, and this is 2004,
2005. 20 years ago.
So yeah. it's kind of before even the iPhone came out.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's different time of BlackBerry, but you know, but the way that kids now are sucked into it was not part of it because the things were too costly then.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting to see like, oh, these guys kind of like presented an idea that no one even really thinks about when they think about that movie. And then if you look at Elysium, it takes place in like a version of Los Angeles
right.
that is so stripped of everything that there's just immigrants and like waste like fights. And it's pretty shocking. And again, it's like no one thought that was, I mean, that movie was, had some other problems.
Or like
the
rich
it.
People like in space.
They're
or
all
somewhere.
Space. Yeah. They're in the Elysium, their space center, right. their space, they're floating with their satellite above the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that's what the, I mean, why do you think that Bill, what's his name, Jeff Bezos is doing the Blue Horizon thing? They want this. So that's, you know, that's
what
the fear.
What do you got to say for yourself,
yeah,
Rich?
Yeah, that's the fear. So,
what do you got to say for yourself, Rich? I know you're trying to go up there with them.
No. I mean, this is all about the elitism in today's society,
right.
You know, where the billionaire class and the people with hundreds of millions of dollars, they just want what's theirs. And they don't right. care about the rest of certainly, they don't care about the rest of the world. They don't care about the United States. They don't care about the people
right.
in the United States. They just want theirs.
Yeah.
And that's yeah. it.
So I was saying, Chris, I invited Rich to come hang. He's been listening to the show. We met for lunch and got a chance to catch up on some stuff. And he has an interesting story. But more so, I think one of the things that I think is important, and you and I know as being advocates for, usually we always talking to the younger writers, but I think this is our chance to talk to, you know, a writer, I don't want to, you know, say whatever age you are, but a writer over 50, who is like, you're starting your career over again. You know what I mean? And he's written a whole bunch of scripts and they're good. And you know, I would tell you.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you can write. And otherwise, I wouldn't let you sit here. I'd be like, no, you can sit over there. No, I'm kidding. And I was telling Chris offline before we started that one of the things that I'm always saying, like when I get my writer's rooms, I'm going to be one of those guys who does have women and men over 50 in my room, along with, you know, whatever the other characters are that you need for your show, because wisdom is an important thing to me. And you hear me say a lot of times, when you figure out that the thing you are trying to keep people from knowing about you, like if you don't fully understand why being a lawyer is a good thing and how to tie it into the things you write, it's a waste of saying you're a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You hear where I'm going with that?
Yeah, well, because, you know, it's you know, something that kind of like hobbled my career for a minute is that you have to embrace the thing that is your uniqueness, you know, and if you spent a career as an attorney, there's a lot about that that is unique. It's not just the law. It's right. like there's a way of like thinking about problem solving and about, you know, you have to be creative in the negotiations. You got to be mm-hmm. creative when you're coming up with contracts or, you know,
research.
I mean, that, you know, that is part of the skill set that would help a writer. You know, and there's also been tons of writers who transitioned from attorneys who are successful. Sure. Like Mark Guggenheim was attorney
right.
for a while.
Right.
So was Ron Bass was an attorney for a long time. You know, I mean, and these are people who are like big writers now.
Right.
You know, but there's a lot of people I've met all along the way who started as a career as a yeah. lawyer and then turned away. But you know, whatever, 20s, 30s. You know, it's interesting. It's like there was someone on Twitter the other day. Not on Twitter, but it was on Instagram, and I posted this on Twitter. He was like shitting on Ron Perlman's Instagram.
What? Really?
Yeah.
I love Ron Perlman.
And he was saying, I don't care about your cushy life. You made like some bad life decisions
mm-hmm.
to be an actor that now needs to go on strike. And I'm
what?
Saying, you know, and so I said to myself, this guy is essentially saying that someone whose career is designed to be the safety valve for the rest of society, you think is pointless.
Wow.
You know? And so I put that on Twitter and people were like, oh, it's because someone told him a long time ago he's not allowed to be creative.
yeah, that makes sense.
You know? When he was a kid, someone said, you're not allowed to be creative. Mm-hmm. And I feel like...
That's not a real job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel like what you're saying, the transition is...
You relate to that, don't you, Rich?
Well, first of all, when you go to law school, one of the first things they do is say, you have to think like a lawyer. Mm-hmm. Forget how you've been thinking before this. Now you have to think like a lawyer. This word over here, it has one meaning and one meaning alone.
Wow.
This is not a creative writing class. And they, for 3 years, strip you of your creativity on purpose.
Huh.
So that as a lawyer, you recognize that one word and know it means this one thing.
Wow.
And whether it's in a contract or whether it's in a statute, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it takes a long time to recover from that.
Yeah, but see, so a good side note on that is the reason why SAG and AFTRA are now a single union is because in the SAG contract in 2008, it said SAG contracts cover all filming. And because they were shooting on digital video at the time, that wasn't considered filming. Like the attorneys were like, that's not considered filming.
Crazy.
So we don't have to now pay you. So this doesn't have to be covered by the SAG thing, you know? So the next contract, so SAG and AFTRA had to merge. And the next contract negotiation, it was something, they changed it to be more inclusive. Like it's like recording, it's like recording a performance is what it says now or something like that. But it's like, that's again, the thinking of like, you gotta be thinking so many steps ahead.
But here's an interesting thing. I remember when I was an actor and I would book like a commercial on, I feel like this is, I might be remembering this wrong. But I remember I'd get a job on AFTRA and I felt like I made more money on the AFTRA contract than I did on the SAG contract sometimes.
Might have been.
And I can't remember what the reason, it's been so long since I've done it.
I don't know. I've never seen the contract. I mean, like it could be the number, it could be the residual, not the residuals, the dues could be, like at the time could have been higher on SAG contracts than AFTRA contracts. I don't know.
Yeah.
I've never seen the contract or tried to do it, so I don't really know. But
what you're talking about is one of the reasons that people hate lawyers. No. Yeah, and because they build these words into contracts, they build these words into statutes, and if the other side doesn't have a lawyer who's just a sharp, then they get away with it.
Right.
Well, here's the interesting thing, though. So we talk a lot about Billy Ray's Strike Talk podcast, which you should listen to if you aren't, and they're talking about the strike. He had maybe 2 weeks ago, I believe it was. He had a group of people on, and he was talking about one of the guys was SAG, and he was saying, I'm sure you probably remember this episode, he was saying, and I'm paraphrasing, something about, he's like a historian for contracts with SAG.
Okay.
Somehow he just got like really involved in it and started looking it all up and studying it and whatever. And so he's like an encyclopedia of things that happened with SAG. He said in the 60s, if I recall, in 1939, whenever it started, the contract was like, let's say 10, 12 pages. When the lawyers came in, it's now 1,600 pages.
Wow.
That's it?
That's crazy.
And a lot of the laws we complain about that are enacted in this country, and some of which are passed at the last second with no one having a chance to read them, nor could they, because they're so long and so tedious. They're written by lawyers, and usually it's lawyers who are representing the most moneyed interests in the country.
Yeah,
and it screws poor people
for sure,
and this fact of life.
Well, yeah, I mean, like right now, there's a bill in front of the New York State Legislature where if you're a company and you replace workers with AI in New York, you can't get any tax benefits.
Oh, that's
like some tax breaks. There's certain kind of tax breaks. It's not I'm like simplifying it drastically, but they're saying but they're trying to prevent these companies from basically, as opposed to offshoring, we're going to put it on the AI for all these jobs, and they're trying to prevent that because the state knows. Well, we're never allowed to tax, corporations and billionaires. We never get to tax them. We tax the regular people. the regular people don't have any jobs, like you were saying, then there's no money for the state, there's no infrastructure, it's all good. So the whole stuff turns to Mad Max like very quickly.
Right.
It's interesting. It's what's happening. You know, I mean, I always find like writers who have life experience, the wisdom you talk about, they're able to bring more to the work.
Right.
They're able to, they're not as, I think a lot of times the ego isn't as pronounced because they've had it tempered by life.
Mm.
You know, like in you in your 20s and your 30s, you know, or you don't have it. It's just like I'm not, it's not, there's no shame on dude. Jose Molina was on a couple weeks ago. He was self-admitting. Mm-hmm. When I was in my 20s, my ego was out of control. Yeah. But now he's like, I'm very much... I see
that's maturity.
It's maturity. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, see, the maturity. That's what I'm saying. Like, that's the wisdom of the lessons that you learn. So when you come in, you know how to, like you know, I don't need to fight that fight.
Right.
You know?
It's also kind of like you look at, like, an actor or even a writer. You come in on a show and, you know, you were – even Alex talks about it. We were talking about Alex O'Keefe earlier. You come in on a show and you've never made $40,000 in a year, for example, and you make it in 2 months.
Yeah.
Right. And all of a sudden, let's just say that kept going. You know, you went from that show to another show to another show. You think it never stops. And your ego starts getting used to that and you start getting feeling yourself about everything, whatever it is. Same thing as an actor. All of a sudden you get on a show, you get another show, you know, you start making more money than you ever made. You start living, your lifestyle changes, all that. So I could totally see, because Jose, if I recall, it took him a minute to get from that to that first one, but once he got in, he was like on that train.
Yeah, Dark Angel. Yeah, Dark Angel just took off. Yeah,
and so I could see his ego going crazy.
Yeah,
at first,
I mean, it's, you know, I mean, you know,
it was a hit show.
Yeah, hit show, and the next show was a big show. The Firefly, and then he was on to some other shows. But there are big shows, these procedurals, like everything like that. I mean, the thing is that you want people. The thing about like. I feel that the stories that really make sense to us as audience, as humans, the humanity, is stories that have to kind of like communicate something about humanity that you have some perspective on.
Right.
And when you're like 15 or 21 or 25, I don't know what perspective that you have on a lot of things. Because even at 25... your perspective on your childhood is different, and it's because here's what's really going to change.
Right.
The minute you become a parent, your understanding of your own childhood radically changes, and you can understand how, oh, this is why this choice is made. Oh, this is why things are happening, sure. Which you might not even know until when you're writing. You
the
know?
The episode we just dropped last week was with these two Black queer writers, and one of them was talking about how. He was saying that he writes stories, and I'm paraphrasing, he writes stories about like father or son type of things, because of course he had this strange relationship with his father. And he noticed over the years his scripts were a certain way. He says, but now in the last few years, him and his father have come back, they've changed. And I said, that is maturity.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's what happens. All of a sudden it kicks in, and that thing you cared about, you don't care about anymore. You know, or versions of it. You know what I mean?
No, I mean, look, I mean, I get it. I mean, I remember, I don't know, maybe like 12, 15 years ago, I was, you know, like when I broke with my fiance, the next couple of scripts that I wrote, I did not write like the women.
Were you angry?
You know, like, well, in this, like in the scripts. Because I remember this, you know this girl, Denise Harkavy, you know, she wrote a script in mind and she was like, why are the women such nags? Why are the women so blah, blah, blah? And I was like, are they? She was like, oh, you know they are. I was like, no, I don't know. I'm asking you to read it. She's like, no, this. And I was like, it's just a blind spot because you have this thing that, you know. Right. But now, I remember I was looking back at something just recently. I was purging some stuff. And I was just reading over like a short story I was writing that I showed. And I was like, oh, yeah, it's totally written that way.
Right.
You know, because this is a product of where you are in life.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, part of being a successful artist is being able to, to recontextualize what's happening in your life, and then and then put it in your work in a way that other people are able to understand it, mm-hmm. you know, and the specificity of your stuff from your life. That's what people really like resonate to, because they see, right. oh, that's, yeah, like there might be a detail that might not be exactly yours, but you know that detail is something that you can fill in, mm-hmm. you know.
I was reading something, saw someone the other day talking about this.
Might have been Dustin Hoffman. Mm-hmm. Might have been Dustin Hoffman. He was saying that like these filmmakers in the 40s, the theme of a good filmmaker is this.
As you see, Rich, he's a total cinephile. So
yeah. So the thing about
I love Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah.
So until the stories came out.
Oh, exactly.
But his acting is incredible.
It's acting.
You were just telling me he's your favorite actor. Yeah. Back in the day.
Yeah. So
until these stories came out.
Stories didn't come out of everybody.
Hey, I know.
Bro. Stories didn't come out about everybody.
Bro, some people, yes.
Some of the stories in that book about the method I was telling you about earlier, about some of these actors, you're like, I didn't know they did that.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. I didn't know they were this they were this bad as people. Yeah. You know.
So you were saying about Destiny, what happened?
So he was talking about like the thing that he was quoting the filmmaker Jean Renoir, and he was saying that the audience is your co-writer. The audience is your scene partner,
mm-hmm.
because they fill in the moments in the scene that aren't written and aren't said because they've lived it. Right. If they have lived it. And most people have lived it. They just don't know. I even if you're young and I tell you about something, what it's like when you were a kid, you're like, oh, I might not be able to point that out because I didn't know. Mm-hmm. Here's a classic example. This is an interesting thing. I'm at my friend's house like last weekend,
right.
and he's got two kids, and I'm really good friend. I'm really good, like a good friend to his kids.
And Uncle Chris, right?
Yeah, and the older boy wants to show me these comic books that he's working on, like just on his own, drawing his own.
Chris is a comic book,
you know. He's just drawing stuff, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like trying to follow the story, mm-hmm. and he's going down the page, like down, you know. And I'm like, oh no, comics are like they're like reading, but he didn't know that.
Okay.
And I was like, and I had to go. Oh, I figured it out. My friend and his wife had to kind of explain how to follow. So I was like, okay. So I said to myself, I said, how's this kid again? He's 7?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when I was 7, what did I need to help me move my art along?
Mm.
You know? Mm-hmm. And I was like, I remember I got this book called How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way.
Really?
Yeah. And it kind of changed how I looked at my... It made me push my drawing skills, because they show you step by step what you do, the underdrawing and how you draw things, and it's all of like cylinders and mm-hmm. squares and mm-hmm. and
but it also told you that spheres. Format
it shows you the format to, okay, I mean, the format right. So I said, and I remember when I got that book how my art changed.
Okay.
Drawing, I was like, I'm gonna get that for him for his birthday.
Oh, that's cute.
Because I know, it's gonna change how he looks. Because I go to his house all the time. He's like, oh, because he knows I like comics, and I got this new comic, He's always showing me stuff, and I bring him stuff. But now he's drawing, and I'm like, this will help you.
Yeah.
But the thing is, if I was 25, I might not think about that.
Mm.
You know, it's too because I'm too close to it. You know, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking about like, you didn't do it right, kid. That's, you know what I'm saying? Because it's like, I don't have the ability to step right. back.
Yeah,
and I think that's what, you know, just you have to be able to step back. Yeah. You know, the perspective.
So piggyback it. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that being the senior voice here in the room, mm-hmm. that looking back on my life, the biggest change from being young to being where I am now, mm-hmm. is
13, 14.
Yeah, right. It is the smoothing over of raw emotions. Hmm. That when I was in my 20s, I could be hurt very easily,
right.
especially right relationships.
Mm-hmm.
That other things I would get more emotional about, or you know, would speak out about more. I was much more political. I was more, you know, I cared so much about everything. And
he was hanging out with Harvey Milk and them and stuff, you know.
I met Harvey Milk and Harvey Moscone, both of them, before they got killed, whatever. And I did a lot of work in Democratic politics and was sort of like the upstate New York gay voice for a while. But then I stopped doing that. And it's not that things weren't as important, but I didn't feel the emotions as much.
Right.
And being where I am now, I'm just much more laid back, much less emotional. And it feels much better as a human being to not care as much, to not feel that raw.
The thing about it is, you remind me of something that I was reading somewhere about acting. It's like actors have to modulate their thickness of their skin.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it has to do with everybody, right? Because, I mean, in terms of someone who's been an artist, but everybody, but everyone who's an artist, you have to know when you want to be like tough. To hold emotions in or not let things like affect you so much. But at the same time, you have to be able to dial it down so you're really thin. So when you're doing the work, when you're writing, you can get it on the page, right. You know, or get it in a performance and not be inhibited by, you know. So it's interesting, but that's something, again, that you are only going to know through age. Like, you don't know how to do that. You haven't been through enough to do that,
right.
You know. Some of these greatest people we know, like Beethoven was very old when he did these, you know, the end of his career kind of thing when he was doing these symphonies. I mean, I want to say he was deaf, deaf or blind when he did like Symphony Number 9 or something like that. Yeah. Deaf. So it's so his most famous symphony, he's not really able to hear it
at all.
Is he partially deaf?
No. I think he was completely deaf.
Just like he's, but he's in his head. He's like, I know what's gonna. I know how it's gonna sound because I've done this all my life. Mm-hmm. You know, I watched this movie like early in the pandemic called Ron.
Mm-hmm.
It was like I think Kurosawa's second to last movie.
Right.
And I'm watching the making of thing, and they say he was almost blind when he made the movie, and I was like, what? So you look at the movie, you're like, no, this man's at the top of his game. Like, it's so visually rich. Right. Like, his career is so done. It's so much black and white. Now it's just the movie's like 84, 85 or something like that. And he deploys color like he's been doing it all his life, you know, in the movies. And he hadn't been. But he's almost blind. And they're like, oh, yeah. Like, he had to, like, draw these paintings, these big paintings, as his to show the cameraman and say, we're going to do this and I'm going to be in this corner and then this corner. And I was like, this is insane.
Crazy.
But he knew the craft so well, you know, that he didn't necessarily need to see it. Hmm. I was like, that's pretty remarkable.
So we got you here, Rich. You're here. How long have you been here now?
About 2 years.
2 years?
Yeah.
Okay. He's been doing really well in like some of the festivals and stuff like that. And the competitions and stuff, just testing the water to see where he stands and stuff like that. Been doing really well. I read one of his scripts. And you had a reading today in New York. Is that what it was?
I had a rehearsal for a staged reading that's going to take place in a few days at the Queens Public Library in Forest Hills, Queens.
Good. Yeah. You just need to be doing it.
Yeah.
Like you said, Chris wants to do one next week for this new horror movie that he has. It's really dope.
Yeah, these contests have been interesting. Mm-hmm. I used to think it was only the top five or so contests that were worth entering, but this screenwriting festival of New York City had as a prize for the finalists being able to have staged readings at library. And that's great. Why not? So I like these more medium level contests I've been entering.
Okay.
And I'm a semifinalist so far in the Holly Shorts contest here, which gives me a free pass to see all the movies.
There you
Why
are.
Not?
Yeah. It's wonderful. That's this week, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's awesome. It starts the end of the week. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about this, about doing the reading, it's, you know, it's something that like all writers should do. You don't know really what your work is until you do the reading. You don't know what can come out. Mm-hmm. Or what's just all this stuff? I remember like Ed Solomon did a tweet maybe 4 or 5 years ago. He was like saying, "I know that most writers won't do readings of their work.
It's horrible.
They just don't. Whatever it is, they just think they don't need it or blah, blah." But and he was like, "I do it all the time. Everything, you know." Now, granted, he's a big screenwriter and he can get good actors.
Sure.
Or let me take that back. He can get well-recognized actors to be in his reading. But you don't need well-recognized actors. You can get great people who are just working, you know.
And it's for you.
Yes, it's for you to hear and to see and go, oh, this is working, this isn't, you know. Are there, do the jokes work? Mm-hmm. You know, do they not work? You know, and the jokes don't have to be in the horror. I mean, don't have to be in the comedy. There's always a you can find the frequency of your the journey of your story by hearing it read, because an actor will go, oh, he wants his line to be funny. I can just tell by the context, so I'm going to say it funny.
Right.
You know, and if the rest of the room laughs, because if you do it right, they're going to laugh just like they would in the scene. You know,
and Rich is really good. One of the comments I read one of the scripts this week. One of the comments I was giving him is he's really good at having a joke on a button.
Oh yeah.
So you end it with a, you know what I mean, and then you turn the page, whatever. Yeah. So he's really good at like every end of some sequence is like a bam.
Boom. You know what I mean? Yeah. You need stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks. So I started writing when I was practicing law in Albany, New York, working for state government. Okay. First as an assistant attorney general, then as an attorney for the New York State Comptroller.
Right.
But I needed to write. And so I took classes and I wrote 5 short stories that got published and went off to Provincetown and spent a week in a seminar with Michael Cunningham before he won the Pulitzer Prize for The Hours. And,
mm-hmm.
And you know, I got exposed to some genius writers and it was great. And eventually started writing screenplays. And 2 of them had staged readings in Albany, New York, with community theater groups being the actors. Mm-hmm. And they were very good.
Mm-hmm.
Not perfect, but some of them were just
incredible. You probably got some things that you can make some changes in your script with, right?
Exactly.
That's the key.
I got a lot from that.
Right.
Yeah, so I agree with you completely.
So I have a question. So if you've published short stories.
Yeah.
Are you trying to sell those now in Hollywood?
No. I haven't. They were published either in university journals or in, it's funny, the first short story I ever wrote, a friend of mine was a wonderful writer and he mm-hmm. said, I said, I want to write. So he said, well, try a short story. So I wrote it and he changed a couple words for me and he said, this is great. I said, really? And so I said, well, I'm going to send it out to at the time there was this famous gay magazine called Christopher Street in New York City. And so I sent it to them. And 3 days later, they called me and they said, this is wonderful. We're publishing it word for word.
That's cool.
I said,
word for word.
Oh,
wow.
Oh, this is easy. Writing's easy. Not.
My point is this.
But no, I haven't.
You should look into that because short stories now are viewed as a highly viable.
Intellectual property.
Yeah. It's almost like a friend of mine. Screenwriter, he's actually writing a short story version of like 4 of his spec scripts because he knows that he can send that to people. If they like it, they got to buy the rights to that.
Oh, interesting.
You know, and then he's like, I already have a movie, a script for it, but they got to buy the underlying rights from the, and it doesn't look like a spec script. It's like, oh, you adapted something. Right. Particularly if it was published, you go, hey, and the fact that it's published is like, someone else vouched for it. Right. It must be gold.
Exactly.
It must be gold if someone else vouched for it because I, as an executive with a 6-figure salary, can't tell what's gold. And someone else tell me that. So
yeah, I have copies of all of them sitting in a box, you know, getting yellowed and browned.
That's funny. I don't know if you know this, Chris, but I used to, it's funny that I'm doing this podcast now because there was a, you know, in my whole scooter world, there was a magazine called Scoot Magazine. And somebody asked me, because I know Fishbone and the Untouchables, is like, would I interview this person or that person? And then that chain started, and I probably did like 5 or 6 different ones in these cool little articles. And it would start off like, I'm sitting here above the sun listening to blah, blah, blah. I can hear the music above. Like, it was just like this whole different voice of mine that I never use anymore. But they were like these great little interviews that I did that were in the magazine. I have to see if they're online. They got to be online now.
Yeah, probably online. Archive. Yeah, for sure.
No, thanks for that. I should take a look at my short stories and see if there's anything there.
There might be something there.
I haven't read them because, forever.
Yeah.
You know, I tell people all the time, there was a time when I wasn't writing pilots or spec pilots.
It was a couple of years almost, wasn't it?
Because like about 3 years, I wasn't writing screenplays or pilots. I was just writing short stories.
That's great. It's a great muscle, though.
It is. You know. It is.
Because it like helps you get to a story point very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You have no fluff. You got to really capture someone in like 3 lines, 4 or 5 lines up front. And then you got to move fast through the story. Right. And it's very similar to what's going to happen in, you know, the muscle of I can't let my hand loosen off your neck when I'm choking you with the story that you would get in a short story that you would when you are writing a movie or a television show.
Right.
Because the thing that always hurts people whenever they're writing those things is those moments when it begins to slow down. They think it's got to slow down.
Right.
And stories do have to slow down. But they
There's rise and fall.
Rise and fall. Yeah. But in the movie, it's like it slows down, but the burner on the conflict doesn't turn down. It's still got to stay up. That's the thing that you learn. At least that's what I learned when I was like writing short stories.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, I just can't have these digressions. Might be cool. Might sound cool. That's this makes it a novella or a novel. Because I'm not trying to just one fast thing.
Yeah.
And that one fast thing is what, you know, I mean, honestly, there's like a bunch of short stories that actually have been made into movies.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. Because remember, Lisa had this black little girl Medusa Western type of a thing. I don't know if you ever read that.
Yeah.
And there was like some big actress who reached out to her like 5 years ago, whatever, to do it. I don't know whatever happened with it, but I know that they wanted it. There was an English actor too, if I recall. Somebody.
Yeah, because the Tom Cruise thing with Spielberg, The Minority Report, that was a short story.
Oh, is it? Okay.
AI was a short story. There's a lot of them. There's a lot more than people think, you know?
Right. So let me ask you, Rich. So now you're here in Hollywood. He's been out there on the picket lines with us a little bit. It must be interesting for you getting here like a year ago, you probably saw like, oh, there's so many things that can happen, and then boom, here we are on the strike.
Yeah.
You know, what I keep telling all the pre-WGA writers is there is a light at the end of the tunnel. It's what we'll end up with, we don't know yet. We never get everything we want, but it'll be better usually for those coming up. You know, it'll be better for us too, but specifically, it's usually about those coming up, in my opinion. And so, what's it been like for you, you know, out there? Like, are you like going, shit, should I move back to Albany or fucking Palm Springs? Like, what are you dealing with right now? What's going on?
No, I love, first of all, I love it here. And I used to, when I was doing a lot of writing years ago, I would come out here once a year and meet with people. I had an agent out here. He set up some meetings for me. I'd go to pitch festivals, the big ones, the little ones. And I was getting known a little bit, but unfortunately my mother and sister both got seriously ill.
Okay.
And my sister especially lingered for many, many years. And so, you know, I would have loved to just cash it all and move out here all those years ago when I was still young enough to get cast or to get staffed on a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, I had to just keep working at a hard job and apply for promotions, which I got, and keep earning money, all of which went to them, their health care. Right. Eventually, after my sister passed away in 2019, I was able to move out to the California desert for a couple of years and then fix a place, sell it, and be able to afford West Hollywood. That's where I am now. I have a 37-year pension from the state of New York. I have Social Security. I'm doing fine.
Okay.
I don't need the paycheck.
Yeah. And you're not extravagant and shit.
Oh God, no. I don't travel. I don't. You know, I don't buy expensive.
He pretty much drive. He doesn't even drive his car that much. He walks or takes the bus.
Yeah, I walk. The other day, Hilliard and I had lunch here, and I just walked down. He's like, "Why are you all sweated up?"
I said, "I walk." It wouldn't be that bad if it wasn't so hot. But
yeah, but it's nice being able to afford to live here and not to have to break in for economic reasons, but for creative reasons, I have to break in. I need it. I've needed this for so many years, and I still want it to happen. But it's not because of the economics of it.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I totally feel what you're saying. I mean, people want to – this is the thing that – this goes back to this thing with the AI and just everything. It's like we've been telling stories – for 20,000 years. You go back and look at those cave paintings in Lascaux in France, and it's like that's, I don't know how, 20, maybe 40, 100,000 years ago. It's like that's someone telling a story.
Right.
Like, hey, sure. Watch out, or hey, this is what we did, or blah, blah, blah. And it's like we have to do it. And I think it's to seed that away to a computer, mm-hmm. I think will just hurt humanity. It's just something that we all are. It's all. I mean, look, it's driving you to want to do it, and it's not about the money. That's the thing. Yeah. The thing. See, the thing about. I remember Mark Guggenheim wrote on his Substack called Legal Dispatch, which is really good too. I'll put that in the show notes too. He said, a big reason why we're striking is, you can pay us shitty, and you can treat us shitty, but you can't do both.
Interesting.
You know, it's one or the other. Yeah. You know, because a lot of times people are getting treated shitty, getting paid well.
Yeah, yeah. You're willing to. You're not willing to take them both.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Or you know, I'm getting paid well.
Right.
Or whatever. You know, I'm not getting paid well, but I'm getting treated well.
Right.
You know, but when you treat someone shitty and don't pay them, mm-hmm. it starts feeling like slavery. Yeah. At least people think about slavery because yeah. no one really knows what slavery is about. But they feel like, God damn, like what am I, like it's like, what it is that like you're being abused and devalued. And that's like, and that's something that we in this country particularly have fought against since the founding of the country. It's the ethos of the country. It's like, you're not going to do that to us. You're not going to treat us bad and not pay us.
Right.
So that's, I mean, and that's the thing that you're like, it's like, I want to be able to do it. It's not that I want the money. It's not that I want to, I want to be fulfilled creatively.
And to be more specific, I want to be a creator. And the whole notion of being a creator is so powerful. It's interesting because I'm a devout atheist. I don't believe there's such a thing as a God or anything like that. Sorry. But however, interestingly, when scholars refer to the first, you know, writings of the Old Testament,
right.
And to who wrote that, as opposed to that being a deity, right. It's the J writer who wrote the Jewish Bible. Mm-hmm, that's what they refer to, and that makes sense that it was a Jewish guy, a Jewish woman who wrote it, mm-hmm. you know, and it was about creation and created this whole universe right. of stories of people who may not have existed but brought them to life for generations of people, and that whole idea of bringing life into the world. That creative instinct, I think, is something that runs throughout humanity.
Yeah.
Some people want to create children. And mm-hmm. They have children. Right. They're creators. Right. Those of us.
Yeah, I never thought about that.
No, but I mean, but what you're saying is, it's like, look, it's like the quest of humanity. It's like, look, I want to create like children. I want to create this city. I want to create some sort of legacy. Like it, you know, it like almost everything we do. Particularly as men, is we want to create something that's mm-hmm. going to last, you know, that's like physical, that's there, you know. Right. And women, you know, they want to do that too, but they also have the ability to create life, you know, well, to carry life. it's just part of us.
Yeah.
And I think to abdicate it is one thing that's okay if you choose to do that. Like we said before, that earlier I was telling that guy, somebody told that guy as a kid, you can't be creative.
Right.
You don't have the, so that part of humanity has been stripped from this person to a degree. And I feel like we need to, there's a really interesting.
He was deflecting his own.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I've always been a big fan of J.D. Salinger. Really inspired me to write. Mm-hmm. And yes, Catcher in the Rye is wonderful, but I especially liked Salinger's creation of the Glass Family. Mm. And Franny and Zoe, mm-hmm. Seymour and Introduction, you know, nine stories. The Glass Family is remarkable, and I don't know for a fact that that's what he was writing forever
right.
in his little cabin in New Hampshire. But I like to think that what he was doing was just interacting with the Glass Family that became his family. Mm-hmm. And he was just writing down all his interactions with them. And of course, I'd love to see what those stories are. But Franny and Zoe, with all its mysticism and all his short stories, they're just so ridiculously wonderful. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all about this, the interweavings of this family and mm-hmm. and what's going on in their minds. And he just, I just felt for these people that he created so much.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's interesting. Hope that he just continued.
It's really interesting when you read, that's again about the short stories, that people know how to do stuff. You know, there's a short story is like more akin to a poem in that you're doing these kind of potent sentences, potent paragraphs that have to like say much more than what there's really there. You know, like you might spend a 2 pages, a chapter explaining something in a novel mm-hmm. that maybe you got to do in like 3 sentences in a short story.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And the beauty of that is like, that's what you're talking about. But the thing that's really interesting, what you're saying about being a creator is, you know, when you do that and it's successful, there's this feeling you get that's kind of hard to describe, but I'm mm-hmm. sure you know what it is mm-hmm. when you finish something and you know it's working.
Right.
Like, oh yeah, this is awesome. Well,
it's funny you say that because I've been telling you I've been having a hard time writing. So I don't know if I told you this, Rich. So I directed this documentary for like the past 7 years. And we finally, when I took that job developing with the showrunner last year, when it ended, I finally had found another writer to come in to help me write the script because I was too busy. So she finally sent me the second pass last week. So I finally spent a couple of days last week, Chris, mm-hmm. Fixing the script.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it, all of a sudden I snapped like out of whatever the funk that I was in. Now I feel like, oh, I could write anything again. Like it literally clicked in just like that, even though it's a completely different format, you know, doing a documentary. But it clicked back in. I was like, I was feeling great. You know, so yeah, I'm like back. I feel like I'm back.
You feel like the story begins to come together. Yeah. Like, you know, like I'm working on something it's a writing job. It's not for the guild. It's not scabbing. It's mm-hmm. a different industry. But I was very much like unsure like how to, what is it going to be like writing it? You mm-hmm. know, I was like, what is this? You know, blah, blah. But, you know, I sat down. I've been doing this new thing. This new way to get into a flow state.
Okay.
Very fascinating.
Tell the kids.
Yeah, it's very, very fascinating. So I went to this seminar, online seminar last week,
mm-hmm.
and this guy was like, there's two types of way that people like get in the flow state.
Okay.
There's the biohacker who does like the meditation, and the body, and the stretching, and all this kind of stuff.
The method actor, right?
There's all this kind of stuff.
Right.
You might spend 2 hours. I got to go for a run, blah, 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 and then I get into the flow state.
Right.
But it might not last that long because I've spent all this time in the day, like 2 or 3 hours. You mm-hmm. know? Or there's the billionaire that everyone's interested in, or the multimillionaire guy
yeah.
who's at it from crack of dawn till, you know, to midnight right. oil. And he burns out or she burns out after mm-hmm. a little bit. This guy was saying, you got to find what is the balance of both. Like, how do you get into the flow state fast like the billionaire,
right.
but then don't burn yourself out? So he was like, this is what you do. You prepare the work that you want to do in the morning. You prepare it the night before.
Okay.
It's your books, your, whatever, your scripts, whatever it is, you need to put it out. So there's no distraction, no friction to get into the work. All right?
It's just, so it's all prepared.
It's all prepared.
Okay.
Everything's prepared. And you kind of gauge it out for like 1 hour to 3 hours of a block.
Right.
Then the minute your alarm goes off,
mm-hmm.
you go and work. No shower, nothing. Just hour and a half.
I never did this.
You know?
Go ahead.
Now. Boom.
Yeah.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because the flow state,
mm-hmm.
per this guy in his research, I've been listening to this guy for some time, the flow state of the brain waves
mm-hmm.
is very similar to the theta,
sleep
to the sleep. To the sleep.
Ah,
so it's easier to get into that when you're coming out of a sleep. You just work. It might take, you know, 2 or 3 minutes of waking up, but right. your brain is there. And then you're just there in the flow for about 1 hour or 90 minutes. And then you get up and do the rest of your day.
Okay.
Do the, you know, like, yeah, hey, yeah. I got to go to the gym. I got to shower. I got to right. blah, 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 blah. Because then you know you got that work done. And you've done it with no distractions at all, you know? So I started doing it this past week. And I was able to do it like 3 days of the week, you know?
Yeah.
It was Friday of last week, so it's been 10 days, over 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
But I did it this morning. I got up early and yesterday morning to write on this stuff. And mm-hmm. I was like, I got in and I was like, I actually really enjoy doing this. Like, it's not something that I thought I was going to enjoy. And the guy who was hiring me was like, I was talking about network television money. It's not going to be out like that. It's not going to be that creative.
Oh,
I was like,
I've been there.
You know, always tell me this stuff. I mean, it's creative in its own right. But I was like, dude, I understand what I'm getting into. And I was, but he had kind of like gamed the, he gamed my own brain into thinking it's not, it was going to be a little, it was going to be unfulfilling, you know? But the minute I started writing, I was like, oh yeah, I can still make it fun. I'll make it fun. You know, I'll make it fun for me. You know, all the stuff I do to make it fun for me, I made it fun while I was doing this, you know, so that, but that's the thing that that's the energy you're talking about that I'm just talking about that you get when you finish the stuff, you know, that that's
when
that's
Rich, when's your best time to write for you? When do you find yourself?
Well, it's interesting because, last few years I was finishing up the UCLA professional program in television writing, advanced workshops. And in the workshop structure, the instructor and the other students force you to write. And so you write by, you know, from say the workshops on a Tuesday night, over Zoom. And so Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you do your next assignment and do it quickly enough so that
so you got deadlines.
You can, so that when they do their writing and send it to you, you can read their writing and critique it and be prepared for the next Tuesday night. And so that's the tick and clock style, I guess. But I always felt the most creative if I was in an appropriate coffee house or restaurant. And I haven't found one here. And
really?
I'm looking for ideas from you guys. But
that's why they closed all the ones I mentioned to you the other day.
So I had done a lot of rewriting very recently, but not in 2 years since I wrote something new. And when you and I had our first lunch, and you said, and we started talking about being a certain age, and although you're not my age,
I'm too.
But and how we all talk about our ailments and stuff, and you said that's your next script. And I went home.
Hold on. You just got to pitch that little piece you told me, what you were telling me. You were with your group of friends, and what did he say? There was a line somebody said. And that's what made me say it. It was something like, or you might have said it. It was something like, when you're, one of the things I realize when you're with your group of friends and they're all over a certain age, we're no longer talking about this, we're talking about that. It was something of that nature. And I was like, oh, that's a show. You know what I mean? Just a group of older, you know, gay guys or whatever, whoever it is, talking about.
Oh, you think that's something? Well, let me tell you about my last surgery.
Exactly.
That type of thing.
They're all talking about ailments and surgeries and all that stuff. It's funny.
And so I was talking to a friend of mine on the phone who lives in Buffalo, which is where I'm from originally. And Buffalo's number one export is people, and a lot of them live out here. But
damn.
But he's still there.
Damn.
And
it's cold, Jack.
And so I was telling him about the conversation I had with you, and he said crabgrass. I said, excuse me?
What is it?
Crabgrass.
Crabgrass.
I said, what do you mean crabgrass? What are you talking about? And he said he has two sons, and the older of the two pulled him aside one day and said, you know, when I was a kid, you and your friends would gather around. You'd be talking about all this important stuff. And I looked up to all of you. You guys were like amazing. You inspired me. And then you got to a certain age where you weren't doing that anymore. And then I caught the other day, I caught you and your friends sitting around in the yard talking about the lawn saying, do you believe the crabgrass? And he's like, oh, you should see the crabgrass in my yard. No, I've got really bad
crabgrass. That's a good title, too. I just love that.
Yeah, I know.
That's funny.
And so from now on, every time he talks like an old guy, talking about ailments, talking about, you know, his shoulder hurts, his leg, this, that, his son will yell at him, crabgrass.
That's funny.
And he'll stop.
That's funny.
So it's really pretty funny. So I went with your idea, and I went down to the farmer's market a few days later and sat at a table and just wrote for a few minutes and started developing a character, which is how I always start. I develop an interesting character, and I want to hear him speak, and then I go from there. And it was just great. So thank you for that. It felt so rewarding.
It's always easy to help somebody with their stuff, isn't it? You know what I mean?
Oh, I mean, it is, because you just kind of like, again,
right.
This goes back to what we were saying earlier, perspective of age. I'm not involved in it. Mm-hmm. So I can look at it and go, oh, this, this, and this.
Right.
If I'm in it, you can't see that.
For sure.
You're too, you're still in the birthing stage of something. So you're mm-hmm. still like the baby
right.
or the toddler of your own project.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to be the adult and look at it and go, you know what you're missing? You know what you need to do? And some people hate that because they're like, how'd you figure it out so fast? It's like, it's not that I figured it out so fast. I'm fresh eyes at it.
Right.
You know, it's always fresh eyes because mm-hmm. you don't have, when you're in it, you've thrown away a lot of ideas
mm-hmm.
that you might still like. They might keep filtering back. And, right. you know, I don't want to do that. Go away. Get out the window. But still trying to climb back in. But the other person could be like, no, we're just going to close the window. You just keep pushing them out. If we close it, we'll be fine. So it's like there's a lot to the whole process that, I mean, look, you know, you talk about the farmers markets on Third Street Did you go like with all that hustle and bustle?
Oh yeah,
I could totally write in that. I love that.
Yeah, energy. The background noises are wonderful. Yeah,
I can't, but see, this is what I've always told. Watch this though. I've said this many times. There are a lot of writers who need the silence. Right. You just as an example, you might be somebody who needs to close the windows and be in your own room and whatever. That's great. I'm talking about, and you also have your own little pre-office in your space. But if you don't, and you're the type of person who needs to go out, I suggest you do two things. Let's say you're your version, right? Say you're the version who needs to be in your space writing in the quiet, right? I'm like, great, write whatever's best for you. But when you finish, you take that script, put in your two brads, you know, make it look like a real script, and then you go through it at go to Larchmont or whatever the fuck, and get that energy of everybody going, oh, he must be a writer, oh, he must be an actor, whatever the fuck. Next thing you know, you're sitting there, there's Bryan Singer. You know what I mean? You guys are having a conversation. That's what happened to me.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So I'm just saying that as an example that you use that as like it's your calling card. It's like, look, I got this thing. I'm legit.
No, it's interesting. You know what I mean? You know, I just, you know, to me, you know, I used to have an office at, not an office, but I used to have a membership at the place called Neuhaus up on, I used to go to the right. And what I used to do is my membership was like the second tier. So I would have like 5-10 days during the month and then during the day. And then,
so you could spread that out?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, but then I have after five, mm-hmm. it's unlimited access every day after five. And the weekends were free, whatever it was. So that's the membership I had because I was working at the time. I was like, I'm not going to be able to get into the day anyway. But so I would go there to the environment change is what I appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I still maybe go there with like headphones on or something like that. The one thing that's tricky for me, like if I would go to some place like the farmer's market is a lot of visual distraction for me. You know, which is why.
But that's why I go.
I'm looking. I mean, you know, because
I'm like, oh, I like. Oh, that's an interesting character. What?
You know, because I've done that where I've mm-hmm. gone and done, read throughs.
Okay.
I mean, I do that a lot. I don't want to do the read through like in my space. Like I always print the script off to a read through,
mm-hmm.
and I don't sit at my desk when I do it. And if I could find someplace else to do it, I will. I just feel like that your brain. At least for me, it needs a reset somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like all the little things that have been nagging you about it or I've the thing I found, this is what I find a lot. You bargain with yourself when you're writing.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this, you know, I'm just going to do this scene easy. And in your mind, you're like, I'm going to get away with tricking the audience because I'm going to take a shortcut in this scene. And you do that when you're writing in front of the computer.
Yeah. Yeah.
The minute you go away and you're like at another place, you're like, who was I trying to fool? Who was I trying to fool?
Big X.
Yeah. Oh, I gotta go. It just it happens. You're like you feel comfortable in your own space and you feel like you can like, you know, trick people, but you can't trick anybody.
There's something about I have this thing, I've been reading scripts for so long, I can look at somebody's script and tell they've never read it on page.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is. Part of it is this. And I've said this. I've read somebody's script and go, have you ever read this on paper? Oh, we're saving paper. I'm like, oh, I can tell. So what I always suggest if you want to save the paper is I think you and I do a version of this too where you blow it up to like 200% and it's huge on the page.
Yeah.
So you can really see everything because that's what I start to notice is when you're a script is like a, I always say it's like a puzzle, right? And it's something you've memorized for the most part. Like, you know the shit by heart. So you might be going through things and going, I could have sworn there was a the there. Because I hear it in my head. You know what I mean? Yeah, right. You start to see all the little, you know, incorrections and whatever that you have. Because in your head, you've read it and you hear the rhythm of it.
Right.
But when you read it on paper or blow it up, as an example, you actually see where the mistakes are.
Right.
And that's why, I think that's why I'm able to see. Because I'm like, you wouldn't have missed that blatant thing on page one if you would have made it bigger or read it on paper. You know what I mean?
You absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the thing about that is, I mean, like, that's just the process of your brain. I was gonna say that's one of the things that's interesting about that program called Fade In.
Mm-hmm.
Like Fade In has an ability to kind of like to blank out the screen and just be on the line you're working on.
Oh, really?
You know, so when you're reading, you're just reading that line. If you're trying to retool a line, you're not, the rest of it is like out, so you're not distracted by the rest of the page. It's kind of interesting. You know, I don't think most people do that. There's also a thing, there's also a little
feature. You got to train yourself to do that.
Yeah, there's also a thing in Fade In called like dialogue tuner. Where you kind of select a character and it was jump from their dialogue to their dialogue.
That's good.
So you're not.
So that's Fade In, not Final Draft.
Not Final Draft. Okay. It might, I mean, I don't.
They use might have draft. A version of that in Final Draft 12
I
mean, or something.
I didn't, like, I stopped using Final Draft like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I have it now to use it because the shows I work on use it.
Yeah.
But I still don't use it.
Okay.
I write in Highland and then I just. And you can export it as a Final Draft file.
Got it.
Does it move it any kind of way, or does it look exactly the same?
I mean, I always open it up and look at it and see.
Yeah, you got
it.
Just
to see. Yeah. It's usually spot on. There might be like, well, you know, like Highland uses, because it's John August, right? So when it prints out
Courier Prime or something.
Yeah. So you make a PDF of it is using Courier Prime,
which I love Courier.
But if you use, but then you'd have to, but then I don't load in Courier Prime on Final Draft because no one else uses it. They use like Courier Final Draft or just use the whatever it is, and the pitch of the letter is a little, so that's why I look at
for
it
sure.
to move a little bit, you know, not like the whole page is crazy, but
sometimes you see, we have a thing about where things line up on a page. Like, I can't stand certain things. I'm like very anal
like
about
the
it.
Widows and the orphans and stuff
I'll
like that,
do something where I'll select all and make it prime for, and all of a sudden it's like, I'm like, what the fuck happened? And then you got to go back and edit to make sure it moves it back up again. Like, oh, I can't stand it.
Yeah, but that's, you know, but that's the thing about it, you know.
So tell me, are there writers' restaurants or writers' coffee shops?
You can literally just put, there used to be a lot more back in the day.
The important thing, which is why I went to the farmer's market, is you don't have to give up your table. You can sit there forever. You can sit there all day.
Oh, that's important.
Yeah.
I know there's a couple in the valley. There's definitely some over here. I just don't. Oh, I know. What's the one right at the corner? Sonar? Sonar Cafe, right at
Solar Cafe. Solar Cafe, yeah.
It's right at like Cahuenga.
It's Cahuenga and Yucca. It's Cahuenga and Yucca.
No, it's higher than that.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
It's Cahuenga.
Franklin?
And
it's not at Franklin.
Franklin. It's Franklin.
It's Franklin. Maybe just Cahuenga and Franklin. Yeah,
Cahuenga and Franklin. There's one there. It's full of riders.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Full of riders. It's a little further for you to walk.
No, I'll take a Uber.
But just in just as an example, called Solar.
Solar Cafe.
But there used to be like Insomnia.
Insomnia's gone. All those places are gone.
Larchmont's Coffee Bean, I believe, has a lot of writers there.
They do.
And Starbucks.
Mm-hmm. I go to this place in Koreatown. It's called Loft Cafe. It's at like 6th Street in like Oxford. So it's like just, it's right by, it's like a block north and a block east of the Wiltern Theater. And I go there, you know, you have to buy.
There's a lot of writers in there?
I've seen writers in there occasionally, but I like the atmosphere. You do have to buy coffee, you know, but then you could be there all day once you buy something. You know, like they won't press you if you bought it, and you get the free Wi-Fi, everything like that.
Right. That's great.
But I like that place because there's like an inside where you, like, there's the first floor where a lot of people hang out, and that's where the food is.
Right.
Then there's an upstairs, like a balcony, which is a little more. It's you sit four people at a table, and it's a little quieter. And then there's a patio in the back, So if you didn't, you know, depending on what you're, what you want. Like now, obviously the patio is too much because of the heat. Yeah. But
you can also punch in Google and say where are all the hot writers.
I found the
just as an example. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. You could also punch that in.
All the hot writers or all the hot writers restaurants?
All the hot writers.
They're both.
Coffee shops, restaurants.
Yeah.
You might find that. You could even say where the gay people hang out and then it'll pop up.
Yeah, there's a cool place in, I don't know if it's still there anymore now, it's Cafe Metropole.
Metropole.
In somewhere in West Hollywood. I went there a couple of times. Mm. This is pre-pandemic, so I don't know if it survived.
Yeah, that's the part. The reason why I was saying that is, most of the places that I used to frequent, I've been here for 8 years now, so a lot of those places are gone.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, you'll figure it out. There's definitely
thanks.
Some spaces.
No, thanks for this.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Rich. Thank you for hanging out with us.
Thanks for including me. That's amazing.
It was good.
I was just coming to sit back and listen.
It's all right. We'll get him back again. We'll figure it all out.
Alex decides to show his face.
You guys are great.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Indeed. Rich, I know you're not on some of the platforms, but you are on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
People can follow you there. Rich Redlow.
Yeah. Rich Redlow at LinkedIn.
R-E-D-L-O.
It's older spelled backward. Easy to remember.
Oh. I never thought about that. That's funny.
It's a Polish-Jewish name that was never changed.
That's awesome, man. Well, thank you, man. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very nice of you.
Indeed.
Nice
indeed.
Great meeting
nice
you. You.
Chris Derrick, where you at?
I'm at Unauthorized CBD on Twitter, Instagram, Threads. What I don't know what it's called. Threads. Someone sent me like an invitation to be on Blue Sky, so I'm on that too. I don't have time for any of this stuff anymore. I don't have time for any of it anymore. You just don't.
LinkedIn?
I'm on LinkedIn. It's just Chris Derrick. I think it's Christopher Derrick.
Can't remember. Christopher B. Derrick.
Yeah, maybe Christopher B. Derrick.
Yeah. Awesome.
I show up. Yeah, but there's that, you know. Oh, shout out to James Moore and the Moses who supported the show in the last month. We love that you did that. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Also, I'm going to put something up this week. There's going to be a poll on the Spotify. So you go if you listen to us on Spotify, in terms of what people want to hear more of.
Okay.
Do they want to hear about craft? Do they want to hear about like showrunners and upper level writers, or do they want to hear more from emerging writers? So I'll just put the poll on there and we'll let it run for a month and we'll see what people say.
Okay. Sounds good. And I'm your host, Hilliard Guest. You guys can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, all that shit. Instagram, everywhere at Hilliard Guest. You guys can follow the show. I always want to go back to that again. I keep forgetting we don't have a Screenwriters Hour anymore. Anyway, if you have any questions, screenwritersrantroom@gmail.com. Please go on iTunes, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor, whatever you listen to. We're all over the world. Please give us a 5-star review. We need that for the metrics. What else we got, Chris?
And you can support the show just like James Moore did, and by going to screenwritersrr.com, you'll see a link to our Patreon, or if you're on Spotify and you're filling out the poll, which you should do, then you can support the show there too, and we would really appreciate it.
Indeed. A lot of good things. Again, this will probably drop in about a month, so hopefully in a month we'll know what the hell is going on with the strike. We're going into week 15 here, so by the time this comes out, we'll be in probably around week 19 or 20 or something. We'll see.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. And the strike is fucking with a lot of people, man. It's just not a good thing.
All I have to say is I appreciate The Rock for throwing out $1 million to help
the writers. The writers. Yeah,
I love that Drew Carey is picking up the bill.
Big shout out to Drew
at Boss Bit Boy, and it's
I call him Drew like he's my cousin.
Yeah, I love that. And the Writers Guild has been good. I've gotten 2 strike loans because I needed the money.
Oh, really?
So
it works.
Yeah, it works. Yeah,
oh, dope.
You got to submit. Put out the paperwork. Because I needed it. I mean, I wrecked my car and I had to get a new car.
That's right.
And I was like, now I'm really in trouble because it's not a good time to get another car.
Yeah.
So there's support out there. Don't feel like you're there's no one that can help you. You know, just the resources available.
That's dope. Awesome. Well, shout out to the Writers Guild. Hopefully we'll get this thing all settled and fixed and folks can get back to work. Hopefully I can get back to that series I was producing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We'll see what happens. Anyway, thank you again, Rich, for hanging out with us.
You
know how we do it on the Rant Room. On the show, we keep it real. We keep it opinionated. We keep it what, Chris?
2023.
Peace, y'all.
I'ma say what I feel, and I promise to keep it real.
Welcome to the Red Room. Boom, 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 boom. Oh, yeah. So you wanna be a rider? Well, you gotta be a rider till your fears are diminishing, the doubts are behind ya. It's hard to grind, and the business got me stressed. In the Red Room, we let that shit up off our chest. Never have to guess when you're listening to Hillier. He gon' bring more game than a shark playing billiards. It's all about the craft of screenwriting. It's exciting when you turn an outline into something enlightening. Your pen and words are like bullets in a gun. Write what you feel, say what you want. Welcome to the Red Room.